So I'm going to be talking about building a high-performance computing cluster using FreeBSD that is distinct from a high-availability cluster, although some aspects are fairly compatible or fairly similar.
Quick outline.
I'm going to talk and give an overview of our cluster, and then talk about some of the design decisions we had to make in building it, and evaluate them a bit. Then talk about some lessons learned, give some thoughts on future clusters, and some conclusions. So, brief history: we started way back in 2001, motivated by needs of the GPS program office at work. They work with the Air Force and with the contractors on the GPS system. Some of the people in the office were involved in originally designing the system in conjunction with the Naval Research Lab. So they do a lot of studies about looking at things like how many satellites need to be up in the constellation in order to have coverage all the time, given some failure scenarios or whatnot, or how many we need up to do anti-jamming or anything like that. So they said, they came to the vice president and said, we need 300 CPUs. And they said, well, we could probably give you those, but, you're not going to use them all the time, so let's make this corporate resource. And that's sort of where my organization, High Performance Computing Division, stepped in for department. So we have a widely diverse set of users across the company, ranging from lots of people doing engineering parameter studies, where they're just sweeping across vast arrays of parameters, and then looking at the results, finding where the sweet spots are, that sort of thing, to all the way at the other end, very conventional high performance computing applications, CFT problems. So they're doing rocket food modeling or rocket exhaust modeling, really hardcore basic. High performance computing. So where we are now, we've got 352 dual processor nodes, a mix of Woodcrest Xeons, which are quad cores, Opterons, both single and dual core, and those Woodcrest Xeons replaced about a year ago some old P4 Xeons. And that's all housed in 11 racks. Got a number of core systems. Called the Fellowship Cluster for Fellowship of the Ring. The first movie was out at the time, so it seemed like a good idea. And it gave us a collective naming scheme. So we've got a shell server. The system that's labeled as the AMD64 shell server is actually probably going to become the new boot server once we go to FreeBSD 7 and go to AMD64. But right now it's an AMD64 shell server for experimentation, basically. We've got a boot server, which also runs the scheduler, NIST, DNS, and the license server. We've got another box of similar error that runs a scratch NFS volume. We don't back up, but we let users beat on it however they want. And then a NetApp filer that's primarily home directories. So that's a picture. See down the aisle, there's a... you can't really see anything in this picture, but the core equipment's three racks down on the left, and there's a switch and patch panel rack about in the middle of the row of racks on the right. The other thing this picture doesn't show is that there is a small structural problem here, and they both may lean out slightly. That was an interesting after-the-fact discovery. We had that problem. So here's a graph of growth by processor count. We grew through P3s, went up to Xeons, and then Opterons, and then dual core Opterons, and then we sort of plateaued at ran out of rack space and floor space they let us build on recently. And then by cores, which shows an interesting, very different graph, in that we kept growing. And in fact, with the quad cores, despite the fact that we didn't add any network bandwidth or any if there are any more boxes, we actually are starting to see NFS performance issues, which we weren't seeing before. We've gotten to the point that just the background traffic is too much. So now here's a graph of the network layout. When we were standing it up, we looked around. The company's got a class B, so we probably could have actually gotten real addresses for the nodes. But a lot of organizations that would be possible, and I didn't really want to fight the battle, so we went and did a private network. And then there's all the front end servers which sit on both the corporate network and the private network, and there's a giant, virtually solid firewall out to the left. So, software. It's currently running previous D6.2, I think it's still P8, nothing else for all of it, on the nodes. We're running SunGrid Engine. This is one rev back. They're up to 6.1. We're planning to move to that fairly soon. Unfortunately, Sun does not believe in compatibility between versions, so you do have to have a flag day in general when you do an upgrade, particularly between major and minor versions. And while these settings technically transition, they don't recommend there be any jobs in your queues, whether they're running or not, when you make the transition. So we have to take everything down, let all the jobs drain out. For a lot of our users, they're running 3 and 4 day long jobs, so that's kind of a pain. That'll be fairly disruptive. Main code that, for people who are actually writing parallel applications and running parallel applications, they're using some form of message passing interface, MPI. Historically, most of that's been MPitch or back in the 4X days, LAMB MPI. These days, we're pushing everyone pretty hard towards Open MPI. We're finding that MPitch is really sensitive to timeouts during startup. It fails to start up. Open MPI is doing a much better job there. It also knows about the scheduler. So if you started inside a SunGrid Engine parallel job, it says, oh, I'm in a SunGrid Engine parallel job. I know who all my hosts are. I know how to use the API and actually start up remotely. It doesn't have to use a hack where you overwrite RSH and say, you know, really use this RSH, which uses the Grid Engine internal RSH. Got a few users using PDM. It's largely abandoned. And its biggest downside is that there's really only a single implementation unless you're looking at Big Iron. Some of the Big Iron manufacturers have built their own, but in general, everyone's doing MPI. One of the exceptions is Mathematica, where we're actually the launch customer on Grid Mathematica, which lets you do parallel computation within Mathematica. Turns out, actually, our users aren't using that functionality. We're just using it because it provides cheap per node licenses. So we got a much better price on the 70 odd licenses we've got for the system. And the users actually run it without the GUI and just feed stuff into the math kernels through the job manager. There's also been a little bit of MATLAB processing, not much recently, and they just have no reason to negotiate, so licensing is supported. And I told all the users who wanted to use it to just use Octave. Or they could find the licenses, but the extraordinary amount of money we're paying them already doesn't get us licenses for the cluster.
Extraordinary.
On the order of $1 million a year.
Okay. So how many users?
So that works out to on the order of $8,000 to $10,000 per user, per actual user per year.
You've been discussing migration issues. You started out with 4.8.
Yeah.
Now there's 7 years.
That's my next slide. Okay. So yes, I'll talk more about that in the next one. So I'm going to talk a bit about design issues, sort of what the just a few points. I've got a 3+ hour tutorial where I spent about half of it talking about design issues. So this will be much shorter. I'll talk about the highlights there. Basically just what the issue is, what we did, and whether or not it really worked, or to what extent it worked. So we started at 4X. Worked great for many years. We basically ignored the 5 era. Never really got us anywhere. The one place where 5 might have helped is early KSE was, for some applications, despite the stability issues, still better, substantially better than libcr. We had a few users who were quite unhappy with the libcr paradigm because it meant that they couldn't scale they couldn't scale two CPUs without using fork. So that was a bit of an issue, but in general, 4 was good and 5 didn't really offer us enough in comparison to the big transition, and that was a pretty painful transition when we did go to 6. I have a configuration management slide later where I'll talk about it more, but I'll skip and just go ahead and talk about some of that now. When we first went with, you know, when we first looked at the operating systems, I was pretty much lobbying for FreeBSD because that's what I wanted to run. And I was able to make a pretty compelling argument based on the fact that our NetBoot stuff works great out of the box. And because I was a developer, I could push stuff back in. That was a big benefit for us. And just the fact that one of the things that we found over time, and I thought was probably true then, is that working on something you know, especially when you have a system like this where the complexity means that you're going to hit weird edge cases much more often. Working on something you know can be really advantageous in terms of being able to more quickly narrow down what the problem is and figure out what's going on. So I pitched that, and we got that in. And netbooting was really the big thing there. So what we were doing there is we were building netboot images. Our netboot image creation process at the time was that we did the install, and then we did a change root, did port installs and all that stuff. And then when we wanted to do an upgrade, we'd just make a copy and then do build worlds, build world, do port upgrade, or do a reinstall. That worked pretty good, except that 4 years later we got to the point where we go, well, 6.0 is about to come out. We really want to make this change. 6.0 is looking like a dynamite release. Let's go. And I'm like, okay, so what the hell did I do to this thing? Where were the customizations that I did make that weren't, good enough to push back? And that was a big issue there. And I fought with it for a while, and basically I eventually concluded that, we could make that I could continue this process. I was gonna have to start from scratch. That was pretty clear. But I decided that I didn't want to have to make a big jump next time and remember all of this stuff that I'd forgotten, because I'd actually, I got it up to the point where it had been before in about a day. But, packing and rebooting and whatnot. But I was like, okay, I don't want to have to remember all this stuff again. If I try and write it down, I'll get it wrong. So instead what I did is I took the NanoBSD boot scripts, the NanoBSD build scripts, and hacked them up to, not create memory file system images, and hacked all my customizations into there. So now I have a record of all of our customizations in code form. And that's been pretty helpful that we were able to, we made the jump from 6.0 to 6.1 to 6.2 to 6.2 with patches. And it's basically pretty much you fire it off, you deal with whatever ports incompatibilities your current port snapshot has, but otherwise I can do a complete from scratch build fairly quickly. And I'm anticipating that the move to 7 is going to be pretty painless.
Just question on that. Were you able to run simultaneous versions, different versions at the same time, or did you have to
our transition plan actually turned out that we had two unrelated events that turned out to be a fortuitous combination. One is we got a new set of Opteron hardware, didn't boot on the 4, 7, or 8 we were running at the time. The other one was our DBS users came back to us and said, we've got this huge job we need to do. We're supporting some guys talking to Congress in 2 weeks. We've got to deliver. We need all the cycles. I said, great. We can deal with that. But we've got this new hardware. It only runs the new OS. And by the way, no one else is using that OS yet, and no one's using that section. So we basically stood up a new head end for the system, ran the new version of SunGrid Engine. We've been running 5. We moved to 6 there. Stood that up and basically had a parallel cluster. The home directories were shared, but otherwise they were separate. And actually, they just ran their 4x code. That worked out really well. There's a big carrot for moving over in terms of, they got another, I think it was 64 machines, and they were dual cores, so know, 256 CPUs. And we did a gradual migration that way. We started moving racks over. And that actually worked pretty well as a transition strategy. If you were doing, like, you know, daily production jobs that filled it all up, that would be a, you know, that were the whole size of the cluster. You couldn't do that. But in general, our load has been such that we could sort of partition and sort of slide everything over time. I actually use that. I use a much less aggressive partitioning now and then to handle changes in the scheduler configuration that require a restart of daemons. And just disable all of the queues, and then as soon as all of the queues, which in SunGrid and are per host, disable them all. When the and once they're empty, you just reboot the box and then you re-enable them and then you just migrate that way. We went from four, worked pretty good, quite a few modifications. I merged some, not all of them. Went to six. We were able to get by with some less hackish solutions to some of the booting stuff. Like in four, the nodes have disks, but we just format the disks at boot time. To avoid having to do that every time, we actually used it. A hacked-up tool that created a bogus partition table in the MBR that was a version number. In six, we were able to move to using geom label, and that's much cleaner. Doesn't require ugly hacks and likely to confuse BIOSes, that sort of thing. So that worked. Seven is coming soon. I'm probably going to move before 7.1. But I think 7.1 is going to be when it's really big. It really looks like DTrace will be in 7.1, and that should be a huge win. I think that combination plus the fact that people, hopefully, if everything goes right, will be able to take their traces and then on their Macs plug them into Xcode and X-Ray and use the traces and use all of Apple's tools, that's going to be huge. And that may turn the tide against some Red Hat clusters that are coming up soon. So now I'm going to talk a bit about node architecture, sort of how pretty much the hardware aspects and to some extent booting that I've already discussed. Along with the operating system, these are the two big issues that you gotta, your two biggest issues in designing a cluster. They are more cut and dry today than they were when we started. When we put this thing together, we were looking at six or seven CPU architectures that were moderately competitive, from Alphas and Sparks and PowerPC and whatnot. And now it's all pretty well funneled down, unless you're in some very specific applications where Itanium or Power might make sense. It's some version of x86. Realistically, it's something that can run 64-bit, and most likely, if you're doing anything that's not extremely high throughput, it's not just, funneling data through, you're going to be running in 64-bit mode. Not a tremendous number, not so much choice as there used to be. But at the time, we were looking at, we basically decided we had to go dual processor. And the reason for that was that we wanted gigabit Ethernet. Unless you bought a dual processor board, you couldn't get 64-bit PCI, and therefore you couldn't really do line rate gigabit. I'll skip ahead now. The reason for gigabit was that, I talked earlier about this wide array of users, from the CFD people to the parameter study people. The parameter study people were saying, we're not so sure about this 100 megabit stuff. Can't you go real cheap and go 10? We don't need any communication. Between these machines, they just need to run. We don't care. And then CFD people are, of course, gigabit's too slow, the latency's way too high. We need something like MirrorNet, very fast, very low latency. To balance that, gigabit seemed like the right approach at the time. We ended up paying about a $600 per port premium, and that's the total cost from the NIC into the switch. That definitely was the right decision, given that now gigabit is the default. You go to Cisco, you just pay a premium if you want 10/100, so you know, if you don't want gigabit. So that was pretty clearly the right decision at the time. Skip back up to the processors. I was talking about, we had all these different architectures that we were looking at. Pretty much it came down, we looked at a number of things. There had been an alpha cluster at the company, but we basically, it was down to Athlon or Penny and Threes. And at the time, Pete pretty much pushed us in the direction of Penny and Threes. At the time, that was probably the right decision, though. In fact, the current systems were way hotter than anything you could have bought at the time, except maybe the alphas. The big reason we ruled out the alphas is the company's other cluster had been a very bad experience. They bought it. About 2 years later, it was up and running after they replaced the sysadmin and after they replaced all the hardware that had been damaged by the inadequate cooling. So that was pretty painful. No one was really interested in repeating that. We at least weren't going to have inadequate cooling since we were in our big data center instead of in a converted office. But nonetheless, we wanted to stay away from that. From the Pentium 3, we moved on to the Intel Xeon, and then to the Opteron single core and then dual core, and then on to the Woodcrest. Our strategy on CPUs is that you've got your usual price performance curve, kind of goes like this, and we try to sort of sit at the mean. And we're not going for the absolute best performance or the cheapest we can get. Try to sort of balance that out a bit. Since our users are sort of all across the board, it doesn't make sense to push too far to one extreme or the other.
In these scenarios, I'm obviously weighing quantity and quality, right?
Yeah.
Do we add 5 more boxes and do we go up to Xeon?
Yeah.
Whatever the questions are. Did you see significant performance improvements along the way on this?
In what way?
I mean, if you're going to go from, say, the V3 to the Xeon,
yeah,
right, you're going to, that's a huge leap.
So we generally saw big performance. We generally saw performance improvements as we moved up. We were buying about once a year, so I mean, a year of Moore's Law gets you quite a bit. Even with the sort of botched architecture decisions in the V4. And actually, our applications did fairly well there in P plus space because we were pretty much all computation.
But you saw significant improvements,
yeah,
in the process upgrades that the people on the end running the processes are going, holy shit, I can't believe it.
Yeah, we would generally see fairly significant improvements.
But so you went for the processor upgrades instead of quantity, adding boxes and clusters.
Yeah, so we had enough users where, so there's more conventional high performance computing users. When you add more boxes, that means you've got to deal with more communication to get the same number of cycles per second, aggregate cycles per second. And so because of that, it's just so much more effective for them to have faster processors. I mean, if they had their way, we'd buy the biggest, fastest processor out there and just throw more RAM at it and cut the number of network interconnects down. But we can't, we can't really do that given that I think the majority of our cycles go into these parameter study applications. So definitely a balancing act.
It's easier to do that than go from 11 to 12 cabinets, right?
Yeah. I alluded a bit to the fact that the nodes are net boot. Your basic trade-offs there in terms of how you get your operating system loaded onto the system are obviously you can directly install it, you can net boot it, or you can do a hybrid system where you do a net boot deployment and then boot it off the disk. We went with net boot because it meant one image. We only had to keep one image up to date. If you want to make a change, you go to the DHCP server, you make a change, you reboot. That's generally worked out pretty well. We're starting to see some cases of loading where it's just getting a little too loaded down. The NFS server is getting a little too loaded down, but it's also a fairly old box. For this thing and one of the other clusters, we're buying some shared storage in the form of a bumper soon, so that should, 44 terabytes of disk running ZFS should help a fair bit there. We had some requirements when we started up a disk for scratch for at least some local storage. That's definitely been a good idea because we do have some users who have loads that look very reasonable on a single machine, you know, doing a few dozen writes per second, which is fine until you've got 1,200 cores doing a few dozen writes per second to one NFS server. So the fact that we've got the disk prescribed means we just tell them, no, don't do that. Go right here. And spool it off when you're done. And then it's easy. The one downside is disks have been our number one source of failure. In particular, early on, the first batch of, the first, 86 nodes ended up with Death Stars. So the infamous IBM disks that rolled over and died. So at least half of them did that. At some point or another. And at that point in time, we didn't have Hotspot, but yeah.
Okay. Can I ask, when those disks died, I mean, how do you get, you guys have issues dealing with, getting the disks RNA? It's kind of crazy. Yeah, we got all this, so all this commodity gear, we got 80 of these things.
Well, they didn't die all at once. If they had, that would have been convenient.
Because you guys have a lot of trouble with overhead or a lot of disbands to be full of one drive at a time.
So in later, I think I actually have a picture. There's a picture of one of the later generation units. On the left, you'll see that there is a there are some knobs and a handle. That's the disk sled. No, this is actually a custom job. The guy who did it for us is at GenStore now.
At least for the controlling nodes, did you move it to array one?
The controlling nodes are all running, are all hardware array.
And also for any of the worker nodes, if you look at the script of names you want to make describe, it makes sense just to throw it in there so that it can still work even
though. Even if you want to make describe those.
My feeling actually is that I'd like to get rid of all the disks. That would be my strong preference. I'd like to go to clustered storage and something from Fast Cerisla on and just say, to heck with it. Take all the disks out, never mess with them again, and make the only moving part be the fans, if I had my way. Our policy on these disks is we provide no guarantees. This node crashes. I never got around to re-implementing it in previous D6, but in the previous D4 with my custom boot scripts, we looked at the disk. If any of the volumes on the disks weren't clean, we nuked them, because that cut our boot time by quite a bit if they were substantially dirty. So we literally, all bets are off on that storage. Your job completes, great. If your job doesn't complete, sucks for you.
Yeah.
Resubmit it, basically. Or let the system resubmit it.
Because that's like, I'm running the operating system. You're not doing like a crazy amount of rewrites locally.
No, I mean, some applications do hammer those disks pretty good, but in general, there's not much going on. And it's only data associated with that application. So if you want a checkpoint and you need to checkpoint your data, and copy it off to the central storage. And we can afford to have you copy as much as you want off the central storage. Streaming I/O is not a problem. Bam, 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 bam. Just writing stupid little stuff out all the time. That is what kills us. Piggy talked about that. And chassis, we looked at a number of options ranging from standard chassis to blade systems. Blades were very primitive back in the 2001-2002. At best, we'd lose a couple of by installing them, so it was not really a win there in terms of density, which was our biggest concern at the time. I continue to find conventional chassis annoying as all hell. We've got two sides to them. You've got to mess with both sides most of the time whenever you want to do anything. I just find them annoying. So We looked at some custom rack mount systems. The early ones were actually, I think, were off-the-shelf IX systems design. The later ones are the front port units you see here. And so there's a power port on the back, but otherwise there's nothing back there you got to mess with unless you're taking it out. Yeah.
Are you looking at blade sinkers at all?
We have looked at blade fit. I ran some numbers, and unless you really, really need the same density, they're hugely more expensive. I ran numbers comparing some rack mount systems or some one-use IBM blade centers. The problem is for us, we need high-performance connectivity, which means you need the top-of-the-line blade centers, and most of them are still incredibly anemic in terms of their switch bandwidth. And so you've got a direct port mount, so you lose all your gateway advantage. And so the one reason why I did kind of push for them in the new clusters is that we're going to have them on two coasts. And you know, if I've got to deal with, and actually I live in the middle of the country, so, you know, if I'm going to have untrained people or minimally trained people messing around with them, blades would be a huge advantage, because, you know, pull them out, ink the disc, send them back, you know, if something's wrong, and there's no screwing around there, there's nothing to mess with. But, you know, we took it to the senior VP, I had a quote for a particular size, we were looking at like 1.5 million, 2.5 million, and then the maxed out highest density was this insane loaded Penguin system, Penguin computing system that was like 7.5 million. There's also, but those are 24 dual processor, dual core units per 4U. So good luck cooling it, but that was fun. So we've looked at blades, but basically we went with the custom ones because I just like to have the front panels. As far as I'm concerned, clusters are network equipment. They should look like network equipment and be accessed like network. That's just me. Apparently no one else agrees in general because they don't make equipment out of it. So let's see. No configuration management. I've talked about this quite a bit. But in the 4X time frame, we were doing upgrades to node images, sort of like you would just upgrade a box. Wasn't easy to maintain all the customizations because, you know, Merge Master just left them alone, or as long as we didn't screw up the merge. But also makes it easy to forget all of the customizations. So it was a little exciting trying to get things back up. Since we moved to these nano BSD drive scripts, I have to admit it's actually the old makefile version of NanoBSD because I haven't got around to upgrading yet, but nonetheless, it's there, it works, and makes it nice to record all the modifications. We do have to have some documentation. There's a few things that are a little hard to script, but for the most part, we got everything pretty much handled. Due to the way we do it, you know, for instance, we rip the root password out of the build box and stuff it onto the sheet rather than printing one not there, that sort of thing.
Did you think about things like blade logic and opsware and stuff like that in terms of management flows?
Not at the time, because they didn't really exist. I mean, it was like APROs were, the APRO custom stuff was basically what blades were then, at least that we were seeing. I haven't really looked at it in great detail at this point. Some of the other people have been looking at some of the Sun, the N1 system manager stuff for some of the new machines. They're looking at, you know, they're leaning more towards the more conventional route where you have the OS installed in every machine and then you have to have some equipment or some infrastructure to somehow keep all of these machines in sync. My take on that is that you're probably doomed, so we're going to give up, get rid of this whole disk thing, centralize it. There are people who solved that problem for us. But I haven't won that one yet.
So you need to do like an upgrade, say you need to install an additional package or something like that. You modify a master build and do the build and you start over your build?
If I need to do a new package, what I do is I add the package to the build list, but then I do a manual install. So like we did an Octave install recently, and that was the end, just true to the image. if you're just adding, you know, there's no real harm. So I tend to do that rather than doing a rebuild because I can get something up faster.
So you don't use anything like CMG or anything like that to push out changes?
But there's nowhere to push out to. Because the nodes don't have any state. That's not entirely true. Since we're using the standard FreeBSD build system, slash etsy is an MFS, and therefore you have to push stuff out to that, I typically just do it totally ad hoc and use PSSH, this old Python wrapper around SSH. Because what we're doing changes every time, and it's a one-off since we're changing it in the image, so the next reboot, it'll catch up. So that tends to be my strategy. Using some sort of better infrastructure there would probably be good. So a little quick thing on physical system management. How do you get all your machines and access them and whatnot? There's all your favorite options from make something go down to the data center to KVMs, stereo consoles, IP KVM, and the lightset various lightset management things. At the time, lightset management was very early or very mostly non-existent. The early Xeons we bought actually did have IPMI on them, but the P3s, they had serial console serial BIOS redirection, which is great except that it hung. So boots failed fairly frequently if it was turned on. So in our initial setup, we had a KVM, basic local KVM switch for the core systems, serial console access to the nodes with the BIOS access disabled. So we actually had to send someone down there manually to turn off all the BIOS redirection because they didn't come up. And what we found in our environment is that we were not seeing tremendous numbers of panics we could usefully debug. So we weren't really using it much. The cost per port on a large serial concentrator is fairly big for something we weren't using. And, we had a little carbon drag around to do node maintenance. Which pretty much worked, but kind of a pain. People kept stealing the cart, that sort of thing. It is a 1500 square foot data center. Somebody needs to monitor if the cart goes away, that sort of thing. So now we've moved to VMC based KVM system, so it's a Lantronics IP KVM unit. It works reasonably well. And then we started rack mounting non-switch, but just a single LCD KVM, say it's $800 in each rack. And that's been really handy because we don't have to drag crap around. There's always something there. You just grab the cable, stick it in the one you want, flip it up, you're good to go. That's been pretty handy. And, for the relatively minor cost compared to the whole cost of the rack and everything, that's pretty reasonable.
Do you have
compressible
power switches, so you can
take out just reboot? Yes. Everything on the system is controlled as remote power. We've got, so we started out buying Matex, and then we had Cyclades TS series terminal servers to control them, and I've got some scripts written up to talk to them so I can shut the whole cluster down and all that fun stuff. We started seeing quality issues with the Batex a few years ago, where now we get ones with sticky ports. And of course, you couldn't debug them because the moment you take it out and carry it upstairs, banging it around in the process unstuck the darn port. So that was real fun. At some point, I suggested we should just get a hammer and whatever one was stuck. We'd have somebody come in and whack the box. I don't think we ever bought one. So we switched to Avacyn's PM8s, 10-port ONU boxes. And those have been pretty good for us. We had the RMA one, but otherwise they've been pretty good. So I'll talk a little bit now about what we're doing on the new clusters, since I've been working on that lately. Is They're Sun equipment, as the person in charge ordering like Sun. So they've got the lifetime management stuff on them. What we're looking at doing there is we're going to install some Avison Bridgepoint concentrators for lifetime management. So we get a single interface. Until we get up to 256 machines, we'll have a single box that can be shut down at all. And in theory, it will all work. Supposedly, there's a SSH connection and a scriptable interface. I will leave it once I script it. Certainly, the Avison stuff has been less sucky than the base hack, but scriptability, I always question. So we're heading in that direction, plus some IPKVMs and their DS view for an overall view.
Have you looked into ILO and Dell Ultimate Hard Card?
Yeah.
They're all IP testing. Are you looking at those in the future?
We've got Sun's version of that in the box.
Yeah.
Right now. So the nice thing about the Avison stuff is they claim to support all of the basically everyone out there. So we'll have a single interface in theory. We'll see how that plays out. But basically the rest of the company is all HP, so it should be HP stuff for that. Corporate IT is HP. We've also got Sunblade centers and all sorts of stuff laying around. But my hope is that we'll get a nice consolidated infrastructure with a single view, and still have some scriptability. That'll be for some time in the future.
So what would be the business to be able to build Sun, or is it actually have some machine that we can study?
That was somebody else was giving the money. They have been buying Sun hardware when there was a possibility of buying Sun hardware. So
he got like three launches in the business to sell
them. I don't know. He likes them. I mean, the rest of the company, you know, networking is all Cisco. Corporate IT is all HP, basically. So I don't have a good feel for the exact reasons. I mean, it's all good hardware. Whether it's the most cost-effective hardware, that's another question, but not one I can possibly answer. So I'm going to talk about a few lessons learned here. I've already hit on some of them or touched on some of the events that triggered them, but nothing really majorly shocking here. I think some interesting things, some stuff that got reinforced by dealing with this much hardware. Two types of things, technical and non-technical. The non-technical probably won't be directly relevant to most people, since they're sort of high-performance computing user lessons, but maybe they're not. Something I'm not entirely sure of. One thing to remember is, of course, once you scale this big, relatively out of the uncommon things may in fact happen pretty often. So the disk failures were one thing. We thought that was initially just a sign of, we've got so much hardware, we're seeing more failures. Sometimes, however, they might be systemic. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. We also had in the P3s, the power supplies, it turned out, were all defective. Early on, we got a fair number of magic smoke events, where we power cycle the system and one or two machines would fail. And if you were down there, you'd see sparks and smoke come out of the back. Come 3-4 years later, we're about out of rack space. We're definitely out of power, because the new PDU isn't in. We've got new equipment coming in. And we noticed that we've got a lot more of these things that start to get flaky, and then one day, the lights come on, the fans spin, but they never post.
They never what?
They never post. They never do, basically no, other than the fact that mechanically they seem to be working. They don't do anything. Nothing changes on the screen. We looked at that. We fought with that for a while, sent things back, whatnot. We finally decided at one point to pull one open. Somebody brought in a power supply from home, jammed it into the socket, posted. And we did that on most of them. Gee, sure enough, that was the case with all of them. And the one thing we did notice is that on some of the fans spun a lot higher frequency, made higher frequency, much higher frequency noise when we plugged them in. So our conclusion is that probably the 12-volt rail was inadequate. And over time, due to decay of some component in the system, it started to sag enough that you couldn't quite get the CPU running. Yeah.
Now, you guys, was it obvious to you to take a look at the power consumption of the entire installation, and maybe what you had was not enough power, a brownout situation?
No, we were definitely not having a brownout situation. So they would fail on the bench.
Okay.
They have the same failure mode on the bench. And actually, we had a managed PDU. I think one of the things that's not on here, which should be, is that one of the probably the biggest lesson learned, which maybe was a little shocking, is electricians will never believe you. Unless they're data center electricians and really, really good, they'll never believe you. They don't believe that anything that isn't three-phase draws significant power.
I see.
We set up multiple systems where we were assured there was plenty of power, no question, tons of it. You know, we spec'd the room for this. And then we get in there and we discover you gave us a 100-amp circuit breaker, and I'm planning 6 racks. Yeah, we also had one where there was that, and there was the problem that the structural engineer hadn't quite done the job, so we had to spread them out across the room.
Was it a skylight?
No, it wasn't a skylight. We had to spread them out across the room to meet the weight distribution.
Oh, okay. Skylight.
Yes.
Skylight.
Yes.
Skylight. Now I get it.
Yeah.
Skylight.
So some other examples of uncommon failures are we had some sort of freak taxi boot failures. You turn port fast on and everything, and you know, you shut down spanning tree. Nonetheless, negotiations wouldn't happen quite often enough. Our solution to that was somewhat disgusting, but I think moderately clever, which is that since we had these disks, we set things up so after you taxi boot, you fall through the disk, which is what was happening before in general. But then it would say, you know, operating system not found. Well, we stuck a free DOS partition on it with an auto exec back that tells reboot. And that took care of it. The one gotcha was that I took two machines offline at some point to do a test, had them configured so they didn't, you know, misconfigure DHCP, and then got distracted and forgot about them for 3 months. You know, this happens now and then. I came back. They wouldn't negotiate the switch anymore. The NICs had actually failed.
From overwork?
Yeah. Just apparently the negotiation process is very stressing. Physically turned
out the
yeah, stuff. We, you know, opened them up, yanked the NICs out, slapped new ones in, everything came up fine. But apparently, that other negotiation stuff is hard.
Are you doing like independent SNMP monitoring with these stuff? I mean, I'm just curious from the system there.
We're pretty lame about monitoring.
Your model is like basically. If you have a problem, you move the box, you install it, or something, you still have a problem with hardware.
Yeah. So we from the very early days we're running Ganglia. Yeah, it's great for getting a big view of the system. What it's not great at is telling you that something failed. It doesn't do that. It just provides you with a picture of its current status as best it knows it. We went to Nagios later, and that's so we get email notifications when the nodes fail, and that's good. It means that we at least know that something's wrong before the users complain. Usually we don't have it fixed by the time the users complain, because that requires me yelling at somebody who comes in way after.
How does the user know it fails?
Their job misbehaves.
their job misbehaves and then so it's trivial.
No, but just in the sense that like
users aren't like connected to the individual box.
Yeah, so they're submitting batch jobs. So their job comes back and has errors of some sort. It depends on how the box failed. With an MPI job, they get Byzantine and bizarre errors and all sorts of different components of the system. It doesn't make any sense, but they do know it's on.
The MPI apps, are they aware of how many nodes they're using?
Yes. So they're aware of how many nodes they're using, and if you're using standard calls, you don't know what nodes they are, but you, in the startup portion, you tell it what nodes to use, or with OpenMPI, it asks SGE what nodes to use, and runs jobs on them.
So are you able to actually, if they get the job and bring garbage back and come to you and say, something's not right here, are you able to actually pinpoint the node that could be causing a problem, or do you have to sort of...
In general, there's enough log information to tell what it's failed. Now, with the MPI jobs, it's hard to tell. I can get a list of what nodes they were running on, but MPI's error messages suck. So you get socket errors associated with the fact that there's no one on the other end anymore, or you got a reset because it was a reboot. There was a reboot, but with MPH and MPH2, they don't tell you anything. They don't tell you who was on the other end of the socket. So they just hit FD25, EOL. Like that's nice, but why don't you tell me something? Usually we can track it down pretty quickly to what the failing is. Let's see, this better powers by failures. So another one, neat discounts. Particularly when we had four nodes with the Death Stars and the exploding power supply, we were moving a beta out fairly often. And the third rack that we put in, one of the guys who is notorious for just getting it done. Screw neatness. Screw using the right length cable. You got a 15 footer and you got 3 feet. Whatever, it fits. My coworker who did most of the repair on that rack. Every time he got into that rack, he would curse the guy who did the install. Neatness matters. It's a good argument for blades. Very, very definitely. Especially if you don't have huge bandwidth requirements, so you can use the switches. You can use an onboard switch and do and can deal with the oversubscription there. That matters a bit. And on the FreeBSD side of things, one of the things we run into is all the world is not a Linux box, but some vendors seem to think it is. Sometimes it doesn't matter much. SGE was fairly straightforward to port. One random guy out on the internet, Ron Chen, got it working, or got it mostly working. We finished polishing it up and got it committed back. Likewise, Ganglia was, there was a I think, mostly working FreeBSD port, but like most of the architectures that aren't Linux, it didn't provide full metrics. A lot of the metrics were missing, so I added most of them. So it's pretty much on par with Linux, although I haven't been keeping up lately. OpenMPI required a small port. Fortunately, the biggest piece of code that was needed there was the traceback library that somebody else had already written. GridMPI, I did a while ago, and we never used it. I did a Glover's Toolkit port. Our current one is way out of date, but it is there. It sometimes works. And then there are some Linux-only applications. Mathematica, for one. Although, as I mentioned earlier, we use Mathematica. And we were, in fact, the launch customer on Grid Mathematica because it works pretty well under emulation. For our needs, it works fine. I have a port that I've been not finishing for 3 or 4 years now that you need to commit. It's pretty straightforward. Likewise, MATLAB, the computation side of it actually runs pretty well. I couldn't get the GUI to work at the time, but we did do a run one time of reprocessing a bunch of telemetry data from the launch. And the one I do really miss is TotalView, which is a parallel debugger. can be extremely expensive. I got a quote in the $250,000 range a while back for a license to run on a job that's on all the nodes. But people who use this tell me that while it's slow for your job to start, at least it means, you know, when something goes wrong, you can definitely, you know, actually get in there and start debugging all the processes involved and really do useful things. So that's something I really do miss. We've had one case too where LAM MPI never actually worked. There was a port, but it never actually worked on previous D5 or previous D6. We kept building it for a long time because it all compiled, but at one stage or another, it would immediately would say call very early in the computation. And I was never able to tell whether they'd screwed something up and weren't doing something POSIX, or, you know, if it was in fact a previous debug they were tripping on. So that was sort of one of the annoyances that we had to deal with, was some of this porting. Fortunately, most of it's done, except for the commercial things. So I've talked about this a bit already in the remote management stuff, but system automation is critical. If you've ever had to do something by hand on that many machines, it's not a whole lot of fun, especially when it involves, you know, a full cycle through the BIOS at a couple of minutes a machine. You know, so you can catch that magic 2-second unannounced window when the BIOS goes wrong. Unfortunately, we found on, except for the very latest machines, we've had to go into the BIOS at least once on every box. But once on every box over several years isn't too bad. And with lifetime management, we shouldn't have to deal with that, like, that junk anymore.
Any automated auditing of the switch to make sure that whatever the switch is set for that port, the box behind is also mapped. Do you have to like that happen?
We haven't really done much of that. We have not, with our particular hardware, had problems.
Okay.
Lucky there, I think.
Yeah. Are you evaluating the new idea thing about replacing the BIOS? I think it's related to the non-BIOS architecture.
I don't know
about
IBM.
Anybody okay, Rich? The IBM non-BIOS architecture, it's a new BIOS architecture?
Who?
IBM.
IBM's new...
Intel. It doesn't exist outside of the Mac or ASUS 4 or two or three boxes here and there. I have talked to the guys who do Linux BIOS, for instance, and in terms of being able to reconfigure your cluster, it's totally awesome. They've done stuff where they completely replace the BIOS, and so you can do a complete reboot in 3 to 4 seconds. So that'd be pretty nice. But unfortunately, I don't think EFI is going in that direction. Hopefully it will suck less than the current BIOS, but unfortunately I think it's the same people porting it to platforms.
So
I've never actually used it because it only boots Linux. But I talked to people and seen demos. They bring little cute little mini clusters. So I've seen demos where, you know, they hit the reset, you flip the power, and the thing's back up in under 5 seconds. Certainly proves that what all the BIOS manufacturers are doing is clearly wrong.
Oh, they're making money.
Well, perhaps, yes. First of all, doing anything, you know, on all these nodes by hand is rather impractical, and it comes up often enough that you need to do something or another to all of them, that you need some sort of automation. So we're using PSSH, data port of that, I think most of the features work. I can't imagine how the previous version of code ran on any architecture. The other thing is automated monitoring is fairly useful. We went around for several years, and that was definitely a problem. We had users would complain about things. And it, from a service perspective, it's much better for us to at least know that there's a problem when the user complains. You know, even if it's not something we can do something about immediately. You know, just to sort of be on top of things, and gives them better one
plugins. I mean, going a step beyond that, if you're doing automatic monitoring and as network queries and replying, automatically ripping it out of the pool, right?
We haven't done much in terms of automated taking action, although Grid Engine does a fair bit of it. So if in a parallel job, there are some setup scripts and teardown scripts for the sort of what they call a parallel environment. And if any of those fail, all the nodes are error. In your case, you have to monitor that, because if you're testing a parallel environment, the job keeps trying to run and keeps getting requeued, so you can quickly error out your whole cluster. There's no way to set an option that says, you know, if the parallel environment fails, don't reschedule me, please. Because its assumption is that parallel environment failures are hardware failures. So it's a nice feature, except for they didn't get it right. To a large extent, Emacs tools can solve all your problems here. XArg is your friend. We don't actually do that anymore, but it's good to have XArgs under your belt to be able to do stuff. Even though I use a much better script to actually run things on the nodes when I'm making changes to queue configuration, XArgs is the way to go. In terms of,
you can write Fortran in any language.
Yes. These are the user-related lessons. One of the things we have is, you know, our company is 2,400 engineers, there or thereabouts. I think we're growing at the moment, distributed all over the country. And they've all got jobs to do. It's not computer science, sadly. They really are computer engineering, or even the ones who are doing computer stuff, and they're not really into all this, you know, code quality, at least not at the level of getting their job done today. You can write Fortran in any language. Or in some of these cases, you can write APL in any language. Definitely have users who are from the old school where if somebody else can read and understand your code, you're doing it wrong. It makes it interesting trying to assist the users.
Did you make that up for that slide, or did somebody else?
I don't know who said that, but I've heard it from coworkers.
Okay. Which one? Fortran.
Yeah.
You can write Fortran in any language.
User don't really want to learn new techniques. If they've got something that works, they just want to keep using it. You know, that's fairly reasonable, but, you know, one of the mistakes we made early on is we didn't actually start using the scheduler from day one because we had to make a delivery. We had to do some of these, you know, GPS constellation studies so that we could demonstrate that, you know, the cluster was viable at the small size and we could scale it to something useful. You know, they'd give us more money. So we just let them go. And, you know, one thing led to another and we got busy with other things. And the scheduler didn't get installed for about a year. Part of that was because we chose the wrong one first. We actually chose OpenPBS. OpenPBS was never stable on really any platform.
So they were using
an MPI application. They were just starting up on the node. Just R shell out to everything or SSH out to everything. Start the job. And if more than one of them wanted to run, they just fight with each other on each of the CPUs they happened to overlap, they'd be fighting. That wasn't really good in terms of user experience. You know, you run out of swap, bad things happen. That sort of thing. Forcing them to use the scheduler was really painful. The way we finally did it in the end and switched everyone over was we said, you know, when we went to 6 and we basically partitioned the cluster and started migrating, we said, if you want to use the new side, you have to use the scheduler. Yeah. If you don't, we'll show your jobs. Show your jobs, lock your account. then we'll talk to your manager when they come to yell at us. And, I'm 1,000 miles from your office.
Is Grid Engine just, job that together in the partitions and cluster into certain sub-clusters and
Well, all of the job, basically, the way it works is on each node, there's effectively a queue. Each queue has a certain number of slots, which typically corresponds to the number of processors. And a conventional job is run in a single slot. A parallel job is allocated a range of slots. And then there's some startup to tie them together if necessary. Those jobs, each in our environment, each job or each sub-job of a parallel job gets its own processor. We're not wiring that down, though I've got some research work to take some of Jeff Robertson's CPU set stuff and try and insert that into Grid Engine. So we do allocate you a CPU, that's your CPU, and you can't leave it. And hopefully that would mean users wouldn't interfere with each other. And they could go off and run dumb, massively multi-threaded jobs, and they'd still be stuck on that one CPU and not stealing each other's cycles. So yeah, switching schedulers was basically accomplished by moving into a new cluster, which eventually grew to absorb the old one. So that worked. But it would have been good if we'd done it much sooner, probably using the same strategy. And we've seen really uneven user demand. This is, I think, a function of our organization, largely. But the top five users use more than 95% of the cycles. I suspect that will shift over time. Some of that's because we've only had a couple of really, really big processing campaigns where people were using the whole thing full out for 3 months. And in general, it's been much lighter. But the top users use over about half the machine.
And that's not a function of inefficient methodologies and code?
It's possible that some of it is, but I don't believe that that any of those particular users have code that's substantially worse than anyone else's.
They just have big things to do.
Yeah, I mean, they're looking at, for instance, look at 27 satellites, consider all the possible scenarios, if three of the coverage scenarios for a couple of areas in the country, if three of them fail. 83 for every combination, and you can do one or two cases as well. So, just a lot of cases and big computation as well.
Most of your work is DoD work?
Yeah.
Do you have any plans for doing build-back?
Sorry?
Do you have any plans for doing build-back for your users? These many CPU hours and rules of
So we don't really, in general, have a strong chargeback model at the company. Do it that way with corporate resources. Early on, we avoided it specifically because many of the people we were working with felt that was the reason for the failure of the use of prior criteria that we had. That unless you had a way to bill idle cycles to something, you ended up billing proportionally, and there were cases where one person got billed three people's salary for a month because they logged on one day. So, yeah, it's solvable, but there was a political history. That was sort of against the whole idea.
Running a GeoIsp tool, those numbers are almost identical to the same pattern in the cluster of geo systems for the web
application. I think that's all of the insights looking outside computer science for studies on these kinds of patterns.
That number of technology.
Yeah, completely. I know the voice of the customers who are that top handful of people who just slam everything all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, I would guess that on a, at least on some cycle, that will be your case. There'll be a small number of users. Over time, that may broaden in our organization where, you know, different people will cycle in for a year and cycle out.
Practice, like basically, you know, since games goes away uneven, like how are you handling, for example, you know, when people want to play this, there's a certain person using the whole cluster. But what's the scheduling policies for SGA and practical aspect on that?
So we've been fairly lame about
it. Can you repeat that question?
So how do we handle the scheduling policies to allow people to get on, say, when somebody's doing a big run? Short answer is we've been a bit lame about it, and not done as much as we would have liked. But basically what you can do with Ingrid Engine is you can set up things, for instance, to have, well, so to roll back a bit, theoretically, one of the biggest problems is that you have if somebody submits a job that, you know, is going to sit on the whole cluster for 3 months, you know, if it's on there and it actually has priority, there's really nothing to be done, that's how it is. One of the things we've done is we've tried to apply pressure on users to run relatively short jobs, and our longer term plans are to set things up so that portions of the cluster are reserved for short jobs, which means that if you need to run one of these massive processing campaigns, either you need to have small jobs, you know, you need to cut it up into shorter jobs and run for 2 hours, write it all out, continue. And you really ought to do that anyway, because if you have a job that runs for 3 weeks, and, you know, we have an air conditioning failure again, you better have a checkpoint. There are very good reasons overall why you should never have these massive jobs that, you know, suck up CPU years. So we've been pushing people in that direction and plan to move to go with a model where portions of the cluster are reserved exclusively for quick turnaround jobs. And if you have a scenario like that, then you can have a job that's got relatively high priority, but still let other people in based on SGE, if anything, has too much flexibility in its policy. There are like 3 levels of major policy. Some of them have 4 or 5 levels of sub-policy. And you can adjust the weights of all the inputs. And it's quite insane. The biggest question, I think, with SGE is you've got to decide what you want to do. You've got to figure out what business strategy you want to implement. And then there's generally some way in the logic to do it. Not everything's possible, but a lot of it is. So, some thoughts on a future cluster. I've talked about some of these already. If it were up to me, we'd be doing fully diskless, get rid of this spinning crap, just be done with it. In a couple of years, I suspect actually that many clusters that don't want local scratch space will probably move to, if they boot locally at all, boot off flash, just to save themselves the pain of dealing with failure.
I think we could do it, like, say, maybe a little 40 NAS in the racks for the local traffic, and then that'd be like the enterprise for the stuff we care about.
Right now, main storage is local to the whole cluster.
Well, I'm saying if you have, say, like your scratch area, the things where you have intensive rights happening. You have your enterprise storage or NAS or SAN or whatever over there where the important stuff stored. You don't want that getting pounded by all the stuff going out of town. Would it make sense to, like, just do one of the cheap NAS per rack and give up 3 or 4 U's and then just have a talk to that?
In some scenarios that could make sense. The thing with /scratch is the only reason you have it at all, it's actually fairly small, it's only a few hundred gigabytes, is that it's shared. So it's somewhere for users to pound on other than home. So we're doing that to some extent on sort of a cluster scale. And the only reason we have storage on the cluster at all is to avoid, you know, beating up whatever filer heads might be around. And we're looking at whether or not we could do something like, use the SAN and enough NetApp PX head ends that we could actually scale. But my guess is they didn't design the SAN architecture to handle the kind of load we'll put on it. So, who knows? I could be wrong, or I could break the SAN. That would make people sad. So overall, I'd like to kill all the disks, make them all go away, and make them someone else's problem as much as possible. But we'll see if we can move in that direction or not. My hope is that I can manage to keep the new clusters netboot, regardless of what they're running. Nothing else that means we can switch later. I've been looking at higher bandwidth, lower latency network options. At this point, with our balance of users, nothing's really jumping out as a viable option. We're considering 10 gig, but it's probably at least a year out. We've got to wait till at least the Nexus 7018 before it's got enough port count to bother with, and pricing's still through the roof. So hopefully by then we'll also get some respins on the 10 gig copper PHYs, and they'll come down to a reasonable power consumption. The 25 watts a piece is a little per end is a little out there. That's something we'd like to do. Probably if we really had to do it today, we'd probably be doing either 10 gig or 10 gig Ethernet or the 10 gig mirror net. As I've said before, we consider blades. We've looked at them a fair bit. They've not generally won out thus far in our comparisons. I think in part because management hasn't put a large amount of stress on the management aspects, on the good side of the management there, because they're really not winners. In terms of density, you get more density, but you get more density of slower, more expensive equipment. So, in general. The company has sort of decided, VP, that we will be running Red Hat on clusters, so that sort of happened.
Is that a political or a technical?
I think it's a bit of both.
Is it tied back to management cost?
I don't believe so. I think it's tied back to that's what everyone else is doing.
I see.
And that is pretty close to it.
So don't get fired for buying an IBM mentality?
Basically.
Also, the VP can say, we have a call in technical support. In his office, it's where my job.
Yeah.
I understand that something went wrong. Just like when a Cisco rings. Yes. Okay, you're doing everything you can. They're not fired. As opposed to saying, well, I talked to the developer. I got stuff out on the mailing list. You're fired.
Yeah, so we'll be paying them a good chunk of change so that they can Google for us. At least that's how I know a certain large ISP or internet company's support is working. One of the things we've been hoping to do is transition so that researchers like myself aren't maintaining all of this infrastructure. Our East Coast cluster is going to manage that. They've managed to hire better technical people in the corporate IT department. On our side, we don't have that kind of people who aren't totally oversubscribed already. So. That was one of our hopes, but I didn't quite have it. So, conclusions, systems in heavy daily use. FreeBSD has done very well for us. It's been a great computing platform and also a great cluster research platform in terms of really having to understand how stuff was put together. The fact that I did all those ports was really useful for me. And the fact that I've already done them means other people don't have to. It's been very good. And especially for a shop that's already a FreeBSD shop, I think FreeBSD is a great OS for high-performance computing clusters. We've got a lot of tools like hardware performance counter stuff, VTrace upcoming, that sort of thing, that really make it a good environment for doing performance analysis and whatnot, and really debugging the performance of your applications. So that's the big thing. And that's that. Thank you.